I know that I've got the best intentions of doing things in this world. So I can't change what other people say, think, or write about me. I just have to let it go.
And that was Maria Halas, former ASX CEO, leading venture capitalist, board director, and the CEO and co-founder of Stride Equity. And you're listening to the Influence Unlocked podcast. Welcome back to the Influence Unlocked podcast. And I'm your host, Samantha Dyback, the founder and CEO of the PR Hub. This is a podcast dedicated to taking you behind the scenes of what it takes to really grow a brand, get an insight into the world of public relations, and show you how to harness your own power of influence. Whether you're looking to kickstart your own personal brand, want to learn more about what goes into building a great business, develop your leadership skills, or simply find inspiration for your own success, then you're in the right place. Join me in conversation with some of Australia's brightest entrepreneurs, industry leaders, and change makers as we go beyond the news headlines and highlight reels to explore the highs and lows of their journeys and understand what makes them tick. Get ready to unlock your influence. Several years ago, I was at a dinner celebrating International Women's Day in Sydney, where I met today's guest, Maria Halas. We got chatting and realized that not only did we share several mutual contacts, including the amazing Cassandra Kelly, who organized that dinner and who I've also interviewed on this podcast in season three, but we also realized that we have several things in common, like a love for exercise, fasting, supporting women in business and building companies with a sense of purpose and great people. About 6 months after we met that first time, I had the opportunity to begin working with Maria as a client of the PR Hub. And at the time, she was leading ASX health and pharmaceutical company, Anagenix, where she successfully spearheaded the restructuring of the business, including several acquisitions, expansion into the USA and Japan, and a doubling of the business. In early 2022, after 16 years in that top job, Maria stepped down and has now returned to the field of corporate finance and venture capital, helping early stage startups and pre-IPO companies raise funds as part of her role as CEO at Stride Equity, Australia's first venture capital-backed equity crowdfunding platform, and also a great client of ours at the PR Hub. Maria is an absolute powerhouse. And along with being an expert in all things funding, startups, and public company listings, serves as a non-executive director of the Garvan Research Foundation, is a graduate of the Australian Institute of Company Directors, the AICD, also a member of the Chairman's Mentoring Program there, and look, just a lot of fun and a pleasure to be around. So today she's here in the studio with me, and I'm delighted. Welcome, Maria.
Thank you, Sam. It's so wonderful to be here.
We finally get to chat. I know that I've had a few people on the podcast as well that you also know well and respect and have worked with. So I'm pretty excited to share your story today.
Yes, I was wondering when I'm going to get invited.
Well, we're here. And so, look, no better time to get into the first question, which I love to throw at my guests. What is your one word for today and why?
I was thinking about that and I think it's pumped. And one reason is, of course, coming here. And it's so wonderful to talk to you, as always. But perhaps other reasons are that everything is, you know, I open my email, I open my messages, and they're just wonderful people, wonderful opportunities. So this is how I kind of feel.
It's a really positive, good word to kick off the show. I like that one. I actually want to go from the present to the past and reflect on 15-year-old Maria. If she was to catch up with you today for a coffee or juice, would she be surprised at who you are?
I think she would be astonished. In one way, she'd be really surprised that I still haven't saved the world and stopped all the wars and fed all the hungry children. I think she'd be slightly surprised about that because I was pretty committed to do that. Mm. But the other thing is when I look back, 15 years old, in Hungary, in a small town, in a selective high school, amongst really conservative teachers and people, I don't think that Maria could have imagined me living in Sydney in this wonderful environment with all these amazing opportunities. So absolutely. Maria, 15 years old, would be very surprised.
And I want to stay on that reflective note. And maybe you want to stay there as 15-year-old Maria or we go somewhere else. But I'd love to hear more about the three most defining moments in your life that have really shaped who you are today.
So the three most significant moments, and I think really changed me and made me who I am, are really losing my brother when I was 18, and then migrating to Australia, and then becoming a mother. So those are the three big things that I think made me a completely different person. They were real sliding doors.
And let's explore all of those and go a little bit deeper. Let's start with losing your brother. And I know a little bit about your journey, but perhaps for the listeners, take us through, you know, I know you were still a teenager yourself when you did lose your brother and you were living in Hungary. Take us through, you know, that journey and what happened.
Look, my brother died suddenly. He suffered from an accident and died. And I was 18. And, you know, he was a very complex man. But the one thing that wasn't complex about him is his love for me. And it surrounded me and I always felt it. And so when he died, and as you can imagine, my entire family was in shock and grief. I really became brotherless. I really got to a point where I felt like I have to grow up. There was nobody around me who was ready or capable to assist. My mom and dad were grieving, and I really felt like nobody loves me. That obviously wasn't the case, but that was definitely my experience. I had to grow up. I've always been very independent, but that was the moment when I felt like, in a way, in a good way as well, and that we're born alone and we die alone, and that I really have to figure it out for myself.
How old was your brother?
He was 32.
And so 18 years old, your brother, who you were very close to, he passes away. What happens next?
Look, everything that we've experienced together at that point, I just felt like I have to live life for both of us. And, you know, since that time, I know that a lot of people feel like that when they lose someone close to them, that they really feel like they have to live a life for both of them. And a lot of the things that I've done for a long time have motivated me to really make him proud, to have him along. In fact, for about 15 years, I was already living in Australia. I was already finished with my university and everything else. I was in a relationship. I would wake up on Saturday morning with the thought of, oh, what are we going to do today with him? And of course, he was dead for 15 years by then. So he remained so much part of my life and so much what was driving me to experiences. And, you know, one of the things that happened way, way earlier when I was a few years old, he's given me a book about Australia and Oceania. And in that book, it was full of colorful, plants, and Australia was all green. I don't know why.
With the koalas and kangaroos as well.
With koalas and kangaroos and platypus and all those things that Australia is known for. And we've always discussed that with him, that one day we go and visit Australia. And never imagined that I'm ever going to live here. But we just always had that vision that we're going to have this big trip and we're going to see a kangaroos, etc. So after he died, one of the things that I really wanted to do for him and for myself is to visit Australia.
So tell me more about that. So you left at 18?
Yes, I passed 18 and I left.
And what was the journey like between Hungary and immigrating to Australia, which you said was the second most defining moment for you?
So I had no idea how I'm going to do any of this, by the way. And one of the things that's really important is when you don't know, it's great because you don't know the obstacles. If I knew the obstacles that I've gone through to get here now, I'm not sure I would have had the courage to actually get going. But I came here as a refugee. I had gone through all the refugee camp in Austria, at Dreiskirchen. So I was studying medicine in Hungary, but after my brother died, I really knew I wasn't going to be able to be a doctor. I just really didn't feel anything, any drive, any reason why I should be a doctor, you know, which was previously something that was driving me and was something that I was passionate about. And so with nobody loving me, obviously, I felt that real, I felt like I really need to make a move. And, of course, we can't run away from ourselves. When you're 18, you don't know that. I do know that now. But so I thought, I'm going to run away. And this is exactly what I did. And I figured out somehow that I have to get to Austria into a refugee camp. And then from there, I can ask for political asylum somewhere. And so that's what exactly happened. So I got on a train. I had a little car. I sold my car. I had a little bit of money. I packed up my red suitcase, which had on it Long March. And I really didn't realize at the time how long the march was going to be. And I ended up in Vienna and Treiskirchen in a refugee camp for 6 months. But even there, it was, I have to say, I don't know what happens in life. But when you genuinely want something and you put yourself out there and trust the universe to deliver, amazing things happen. And one of the, at that time when I got to Treiskirchen in a refugee camp, there were families there with three children who were already born in a refugee camp. They were there for years. And no country would accept them. No country would accept refugees. You could really only apply for three countries. It was Australia, Canada, and the US. I knew that it was only Australia for me. And everybody told me, if you just put Australia, they're not going to take you because they want you to put all the countries down. But I just put down Australia. And within 3 months, I got permanent residency in Australia and a one-way ticket to Perth.
And so did you let your parents know that you were leaving?
No, nobody knew. No, when I got to the refugee camp, you were allowed to use the public phone once. So I used the public phone and I called my parents and I told them that where I was. And of course, I don't know how or, you know, they arranged it, but within a few days they were visiting me in Treiskirchen. And, you know, the amazing thing was that we spent a day together, and that was the first time in my life. And my mom and dad, we were just sitting on this bed because there was nothing there. I mean, all I had, no possessions. All I had is one bed that was assigned to me in a room with 38 other women and children. And my parents were sitting next to me on my bed, and almost like I have this memory that all day we were just talking and talking, and they were trying to convince me to go back to Hungary, and I just couldn't. And I just already had in my mind that vision of a new life, and I really wanted to make the move. I just couldn't turn back. It was just wasn't possible. And when my parents realized that it wasn't possible, my mom just said to me, okay, well, how can we help you? And so, you know, for me to, from months and months of after my brother died, not really being able to communicate with them, not being able to get support, to have that feeling, it just gave me wings. So. And I think one of the reasons why I've been able to take risks in life and do the things that I've been able to do is because I always knew that they're always there and love me and I can always go back.
Such an emotional, like such a big moment for you all. And you're still very close. I know that you saw your mum recently. Talking about risk, so you decide not to go back and you decide to go forward at 18, not knowing anybody, to a foreign country, Australia. What happened next?
Well, I landed in Perth, in Greylands, which was, you know, where refugees arrived and for their first day in Australia. I had $50 in my pocket, big dreams. The first thing that I wanted to do is I knew I wanted to study. I wanted to complete a degree. I didn't want to do medicine, so I had no idea what I was going to do, but I just thought, day two, I've got to go and visit the university and tell them that I want to study. But on day two also, I met a friend of mine who is now...
Still a friend,
lifelong friend, one of my longest friends. And this woman was the immigration officer. And she was tasked with coming to the Greylands and facilities and really initiate people into the Australian life, tell them where their social security was, where the, you know, how to buy things, you know, where the corner store is, you know, everything. And this woman with a big smile, Hungarian woman, speaks six languages, hence her job in the immigration department, arrived there with this 7-month-old baby on her arm. And that was in the 80s, so this wasn't recent. she already, you know, marked my territory that my family is most important. I do this job and my family is involved and I'm not going to compromise my life with my daughter. And so they arrived there and this baby just beamed at me and I just like fell in love with her. By the way, she's now a PhD graduate and environmental scientist and recently turned into primary school teacher. Mm. So I just oriented myself. I think it was the first few days I went for a walk in Wembley in Perth. And there was this open door and I heard music and I was looking for work. I walked in there, turned out to be Dirty Dick's restaurant, a theater restaurant. It's better than it sounds, maybe. I walked in there, this beautiful tall woman, almost 2 meters tall, like to me, like Amazonian woman, gorgeous, dressed in a wench outfit, was doing the books. Middle of the day. And I said, oh, I would like to work. And she said, oh, that's great because we've got a kitchen hand job. So I said, that's perfect. I'm very good at kitchens.
So that was your first job in Australia?
That was my first job. And I got the job there and then. I think on that evening I had to show up for work.
That I did not know about you, Maria the kitchen hand. But I mean, I guess that talks to like, you know, the desire and the motivation to actually make a change and do something and take on any job to get a start.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I really didn't care. Obviously, I didn't have resources, so I worked all the way through while I was studying. The other thing that happened, my friend introduced me to Professor Andrew Domahidi, who was the head of legal department at UWA, and he became my mentor in terms of really guiding me through of how I can get into the university and what I can do and all those things. So I think I've just landed in the middle of these wonderful people. And, you know, that kind of luck followed me all the way through since I've been here. And that's what I mean when I say when you put yourself out there and trust the universe, it just tends to look after you in one way or the other.
I want to come back and talk about mentorship and inspiring people throughout your journey because I think it's really important to hear from you around that. That word luck, I hear a lot of entrepreneurs and amazing business people use the word luck and I always like to pull them up a little bit on that because I firmly believe that you create your own luck and I think that you're sort of talking about that. Tell me a little bit more about your perspective on hard work versus luck.
I think you need both. And when I say luck, I mean, we all are presented with a plethora of opportunities in life. The unluckiest person and the luckiest person, we all do. The difference between the unluckiest and the luckiest and the luckiest person is it takes advantage and uses those opportunities. And that's the only difference. But we all have to be in situations where we can actually take hold of things, you know, grab onto people, find opportunities. But, you know, we all presented with those, but actually we then need to act on them. And that's where hard work comes in. Mm. I mean, without hard work, it's just not going to happen for you. I think that's the most important thing.
Thinking about that time, because I know you said the third most defining moment was becoming a mum, and I do want to talk about that. But in terms of, I guess, your career, it has been very impressive. And there's a lot of longevity in the success in your career. You've been in banking, finance, investment, biotech, in a country that was once foreign to you, male-dominated industries. How have you gone about the motivation and building your career in that space?
Firstly, I didn't know any of this was male-dominated when I got here. And I, for the first good 15 years of my career, I ignored it because it wasn't something that I played with or I focused on. In retrospect, quite clearly, the opportunities that were given to me because, you know, maybe nobody else wanted them. Mm. And, you know, very often you find women in these positions because of the poison chalice kind of syndrome in that the men find it probably too hard. And so there's always the chosen woman who gets the job done. So I really didn't focus on this. I think I've started to focus on it a lot more once I saw other women, particularly younger women, bumping into walls, and I was seeing that. And I think that's when I realized that, oh yes, actually that happened to me too. I always felt like I've just had so many opportunities and they're all very exciting. And I didn't really judge that was a good opportunity or a bad opportunity, where I felt like I can really grab hold of it. I can really do something important, or I can make a difference. I just did it.
It's so interesting that you say that, because I think that for me, I certainly feel a bit like that about my career. I grew up not realizing that perhaps I was working in male-dominated industries, or I always worked very closely or founded businesses with males, not females. So for me, it was very normal. But now I think in my career, and I do look at younger women, and I think I even look at the landscape of startups, and you see this every day, is that there's a lot more male founders out there and a lot more companies that get to a certain level where they have male founders versus female founders. And I know you've written about funding for female founders as well. I mean, I guess what would you say is some practical advice right now to women in business who might be feeling a bit challenged in that space and wanting to get ahead, but perhaps feeling that they don't maybe have the same advantages?
Look, you can't change the world. You can only change yourself and your the way you do things and your attitude. I think they just need to do what they believe in. Their passion, because you might have 100 doors shut in your face, but maybe that 100 at first will open, and you just have to keep going. I mean, that's the only sensible advice that I give, because we're not going to change the world around us very quickly.
You mentioned taking some, perhaps like some jobs that you said poison chalice. is there something that you can, you know, an example of maybe those earlier times where you did take on a role where now you reflect on it and think, well, no, nobody else was brave enough to step up for it, but I did that.
Well, I'm not sure that nobody else was brave enough to step up to it, but certainly when I took on the role as CEO of a listed company at that time called Medical Therapies, that wasn't an easy job. It was already in dire straits. That company already had a very poor track record performing on the market. The technology that they listed the company on failed, essentially, and they forgot to tell the market.
And this is the company that I mentioned at the beginning, which was rebranded as Anagenics.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I really had to do some pretty unpalatable things at the very start of my job as a public company CEO, and that is tell the market that, by the way, the technology you've been expecting to get a product out of in a couple of years doesn't exist anymore. It doesn't work. And by the way, all the money that the company raised is gone. And, you know, to make this possible to turn around, we need to take some hard steps and make some hard decisions.
Can I just stop you there? At that point where you take on that role and you have to go be the spokesperson, be the front, the brand, go to market and make those hard calls and those comments, what happened? What did that feel like?
Look, I knew at the time when I took on the job that the company had issues, but you never know until you get inside how bad things are and how complex things are and how hard things can get. So I wasn't going into this blindly, but the impact on my career has been significant. I mean, clearly we've achieved a lot with the company, and we managed to get it to a very different position that is, you know, into a thriving business. But it took a lot longer and cost a lot more money. It took a lot more really communicating with shareholders, really helping the message out there to make sure that whatever we do is actually understood by the stakeholders, which is the shareholders.
When you say it's had a real insignificance on your career, can you tell me a little bit more about what that means?
Wow, that's an interesting. I think good and bad. In some ways, I became known as a person who is not afraid of tackling difficult challenges and getting things done. And certainly I learned a lot and I had some great experiences. On the other hand, we failed a couple of times. And I every time we failed or we felt like we haven't fulfilled our promises to the market, it does feel like failure, even though you understand that, you know, technology fails. And a lot of the time in biotechnology, which is what our business was, the outcome is binary. So, you know, you can't change biology. It still feels like a failure, and it's still perceived like a failure in Australia. And I think we're very different from anywhere else for some reason. We really love building up our heroes, and we also love them when they fail at the end. It's just there seemed to be that crowd mentality. So I do feel personally that, you know, those failures are built into my who I am now, for better or worse.
You know, I mean, we've talked about it before. There has been some not so nice things that have been written about you in the media in the past. As the CEO of the company, you're still a person. How do you feel at the end of the day when you do read those things and, you know, maybe other people you know are reading them?
I think it's not reading them that's the worst. Worst thing is when your friend calls you up and said, "Are you okay?" Because they read something, you know, really nasty. And obviously people close to you know that it's either not true or it's not the whole truth or it's a story. So that's more so. I personally don't care very much. Yeah, it upsets me a little bit and I feel like, you know. But at the end, I could not live in this world if I didn't accept that other people's opinion is really not who I am. I know who I am as a person. I know what I stand for. I'm very proud of the person I have become. I just, you know, I know that I've got the best intentions of doing things in this world. So I can't change what other people say, think, or write about me. I just have to let it go.
It's a very strong message. You're a very strong person. We talked a little bit before about mentorship and inspiring people. I just want to come back to that point. Who would you say, if you were to, I don't know, name a person as being, I know you named one person, but somebody else in your career, in your journey, who's been a great guiding force and mentor for you?
My biggest mentor in life, and that's not in my career, was my primary school teacher. She taught me for 4 years. She was my class teacher for 4 years. And she had an incredible belief in me. I don't know what gave that to her, but she treated me as someone, and I think she treated, now retrospect, I think she treated every student like this, but I just had so much energy out of that. I like sucked her energy up, that positivity is that you can do anything. And so my primary school teacher was really my first mentor and probably someone who carried through pretty much all throughout my life. But there's so many people that I'm thankful to in terms of my career, and it would be a little bit unfair. Some of the people that they don't think that they're my biggest mentors, and I'm going to mention Tony Fitzgerald, who was my first business mentor in Perth in my first job. He taught me how to write. He's also a lawyer. He watched every word. And of course, I was early in my career. English isn't my third language. So, you know, I was trying very hard. You know, I wrote these business plans and summaries for the board and all those things. And I was very proud of them and would take him, you know, these pieces of masterpieces that I worked on for nights and day. And he would hand it back to me. And of course, at that time in the 90s, you'd have red pen, steel and paper. Mm. He would hand it back with 100 red marks on a page. But by the time I got through the page, I learned how to write. And even today, I'm very proud of the way I write because of Tony. So I have all those mentors, and he would be the most astonished to hear this because I don't think he considers himself my mentor, but he certainly has been.
I think it's such an important message. I mean, you probably didn't like seeing all those red lines at the time.
I was crying. I was so upset.
But you took it on board and recognized that it actually helped you be so much better in your career, which would have been his intention as well, I'm sure.
Of course. Of course, he's a lovely man, not doing it out of spite or anything. I mean, by the way, we had to have a very good piece of submission to the grant applications or to the board reports or whatever. So he had a job to do and I didn't help him very much. So he was helping me to help him.
And was he an informal mentor? Did you seek him out or were you just working with him?
No. He was the CEO of the company.
Mm. What's some practical advice, a tip you could give around if people are interested in having a mentor in their career, but they're not sure what does that mean or where do I find one? What's something that you would give some advice on how people can go and, you know, establish a relationship?
sometimes we find mentors around us that are not obvious to us. I would definitely reach out to people who are around you first, because everybody will be able to give you some value, and you just have to think, where do I need help? The other thing is contact people, you know, knock on doors. You know, who are the people that you really admire, that you want to follow, whose example really inspiring you? And just talk to them. You know, you'd be surprised so many people are generous with their time. I mean, I feel very rewarding when I can talk to people. And sometimes I get people telling me, oh, thank you so much. When you said that to me then, it made, you know, such a difference to me. You know, you don't realize, but we all want to assist and help the next generation to come through.
Yeah, some great advice. Yeah, I definitely think that it's not always the obvious ones as well, which is what you said. Now, I've still got a few things I want to talk about. We haven't talked about Stride Equity, and I'd love to talk about that a little bit so that the listeners can get a feel for the project that you're working on now. Tell us a little bit about it. I mentioned in the intro that it's Australia's first venture capital-backed equity crowdfunding platform. What does that mean?
So I actually like to call it an investment platform, because it is, although our from a licensing purposes, and this is only in Australia, but for licensing purposes, it's called Equity Crowdfunding Platform. And I think many of your listeners would know what that is. But I call it an investment platform because this is part of a strategy that we use to help companies being funded. You know, what we do on the actual digital platform for people to invest in is one thing, but we really look at companies, especially emerging companies, young companies, and we look at how can they be best funded so that their funding serves the business's purposes. It will serve them along the way, along the journey of their growth. And one of the things we do is that we're licensed, obviously, to take investment from retail investors, wholesale investors through our platform. We absolutely only want to look at these companies. We only want to offer these companies for investment for others when we feel like we want to invest in them as well. So to us, it's really important. And between myself and my partners, we've got about 100 years of investment experience. So when we look at companies and we want to invest in them, it's almost like we want to bring along other people on a journey, because, of course, there's nothing more fun than making money with your friends. Mm.
And what sort of companies are you seeing right now that are exciting you?
So we're very different to anything else. And I just came yesterday from the S2S Summit, the Startup Scale-Up Summit. And we've seen all these different wonderful companies. And also we've heard about the different funding options. So we're very niche, if you like. We like exciting emerging businesses with great funders. We're not industry-specific, so we're industry-agnostic. But some of the projects we take on, some of the companies we take on, are companies that perhaps not 100% suited for retail investors in a crowdfunding environment, or not a VC backable, because the VCs have very specific criteria. We're kind of in the middle, where we know that we've got a combination of skills. We can get people funded so that they can start on their growth journey. We develop that funding structure for them together with the company. And so we've just raised some money for LiveBid. LiveBid is an insurtech business. They're really great because they've got an opportunity to carve out space that nobody else has been able to carve out. They're building an end-to-end platform for life insurance. And that is from issuing life insurance or finding life insurance from the beginning to reviewing it, renewing it, to submitting a claim, managing claims. So they're developing this for mostly life insurance advisors, but of course, customers like us benefit from it as well. And on their MVP, minimum viable product, they've been able to show around 90% reduction in the time that it takes for those policies to be issued and managed, plus the cost. So again, nobody else in that sector is doing it. Large insurance companies have tried it and they failed to build their own platform. So now 6 out of the 8 life insurance companies are members or partners with LiveBid. And likewise, they've got thousands of advisors on their wait list wanting to use the platform. So it's not a VC proposition and it's not a crowdfunding proposition, because it's, you know, not everybody wants to jump into life insurance first thing in the morning when they wake up. But it's something that it had the right founders, wonderful founders, very committed, great business model, first movers on that marketing with a real end-to-end platform. So we loved it.
And to add to that, I know you see, like, we work closely together. I know you see lots of startups pitching their businesses to you. You're reviewing, doing due diligence all the time, looking at these startups to see what is investable, what's going to be the next big business. Where are you seeing these startups fall down when they present to potential investors?
I think what we're seeing a lot of the time that the companies are wanting funding, but what they really need is advice to get them to an investable stage. We see dozens of companies almost every week, and almost uniformly they will need advice to properly structure funding, put them in a shape and form that is suitable for funding. And we feel we're not different to anyone else in a sense that we would like you to imagine that if you were a third party and looking at your business, you'd be dying to put money in. If you don't feel that, then fix what needs to be fixed within your business so that third party will be dying to put money into it. And so a lot of the companies are not there.
Mm-hmm. And then just to follow on from that quickly, so what advice would you give those companies as the next step? Where should they be going to get to the stage where they are investable?
Get advice. I think that's the
good advice too, not just any advice.
Exactly. Get good corporate advice and put your business in order. And I don't mean that you need to have a final solution to the problem you've identified or the, you know, millions of users or whatever. But just put your company in order so that people who are independent, they're not family or friends, they're not putting money because they love you, but they're putting in money because they believe that you can execute on your business.
I feel like we could talk about that topic a lot more, but I'm mindful of time. I want to come back to outside of business. So what do you do for fun and to recharge? Because you have a huge responsibility, lots of different board roles as well as Stride Equity. What do you do outside of business?
I love running. I'm a passionate road runner. And so if I don't get my daily run in, then my day is different.
What's the music hit list?
Oh, gosh. Right now, I listen to a lot of CeeLo and, you know, I don't know. I love rap for running because it's got that rhythm that, and I can lose myself in it. I don't have to think about it and I get my best ideas while I'm running, while I'm listening to rap music.
How far do you run each day?
Look, I run about 10Ks, 8 to 10Ks a day and most days, maybe 5 or 6 days a week.
And your favorite running track?
Oh, I love the running track around the Botanic Gardens, Opera House. In fact, on Strava, people follow me and I've got the most boring Strava because every day you see me on the same track. And the other day I changed my track and went to Piemont to run with the wharves in the Piemont. And I had a couple of people saying, what's going on? You know, why are you running in Piemont?
Is that scary knowing people are following your running track?
Oh, on Strava.
Okay.
Yeah, I know it's a bit creepy, but I'm following other people too.
And just before we get to the five and five, I was saying earlier on that you're very much into the longevity space and you've got so much experience in biotech. Give my listeners a few biohacking tips.
Gosh, the simple things. Sleep 8 hours a night. Don't drink too much alcohol. Drink lots of water. Exercise. I think the biggest thing that will make a change in your life is sleep. But the second biggest thing, very close, is exercise. I don't know the statistics off my heart, but this increases your longevity by 30 to 40% if you do very little exercise. And the biggest change happens between not doing any exercise and doing a little bit. Even if you go for half an hour walk a day, that makes a huge difference in your longevity. But ideally, you would want to do two things in your exercise. One is elevate your heart rate. So do a bit of running or cycling or swimming. The other thing that you want to do regularly is lift weights. You know, your strength is very, very important. And at my age, when you get to that level, you have to start watching balance. And so I do balance exercises every morning.
Why is balance important?
Well, balance is critical because the biggest cause of death in over 65 is falls. Because you fall and because you lose your balance. And then you got complications, either because you get pneumonia because you're lying down trying to recover from your fall. You break your hip very often. People never recover and just die. So balance is absolutely critical.
We could sit here and chat for a while. Let's do the five in five to wrap up the show. Five questions in 5 minutes.
Wonderful.
Okay, question number one. Do you believe in taking holidays? Why and where do you go?
I absolutely take holidays. In fact, once a year, I go back to Hungary. My mum is still alive. My family is still there. My sister, whom I love, by the way, and happy, and have two nephews and lots of cousins. So I've got a very wide family and live a very different life in Hungary. I came from a small town, 6,000 people. So you can go out there. Everybody knows us. So I go back with my daughter and we go on bike rides and, you know, go on the snow runs and all those things.
Question number two. If you went on this career path now and you could change directions and do something completely different, what would it be?
In retrospect, I would complete my medical degree. And it's not because I necessarily want to be a doctor, but or in a traditional sense. But I think from a longevity perspective, which is my absolute passion, I think I could probably run a longevity clinic or something like that as a doctor. I can do it now, but I think as a medical doctor, you've just got a different level of practical kind of ability to assist people than if you're just an advisor.
Question number three, what's the best piece of career advice you've ever received?
Oh, so the best advice is that there is no traffic jam on that extra mile. And that is just do your absolute best. You to differentiate yourself. You don't have to do anything but just do, you know, your absolute best, because there's so many people that are happy to do the average just enough. Just go and do just that little bit more. Just make sure it's all perfect. Make sure that you do that extra little bit.
That's a good one. I love that. Question number four. What's one thing people would be surprised to learn about you?
Well, not anymore, because everybody now knows that I'm a dork for longevity. But I do spend a lot of time reading publications, you know, scientific publications. And I know a little bit about longevity. So I don't know whether lots of people know that, but now obviously they do.
I thought when you were going to say that you just told us that you like rap music when you're running. I was surprised to learn that. Question number five. This podcast is all about influence. So give us your best tip for people with influence.
Influence is an interesting thing. And, you know, we're very complex human beings and we love putting people into boxes. And if you want to work on, you know, where do I want to sit? Where do I want to be put by other people? Which box do I want to reside in when other people look at me? Think about that and, you know, really build expertise and knowledge and really assist people on areas where you want to be known for, but you really want to help people, want to exert your own influence. And then once you know what that is, use it wisely.
Wonderful. Thank you for sharing that. I could have sat here for so much longer to chat about so many things or things I wanted to ask you about. But we got to the end of the show. Thank you for joining me.
Awesome. Thank you so much. It's been so much fun.
Now, if people want to connect with you, whether they're a startup, maybe looking for investment or just want to reach out and say hi, where should they do that?
I'm on LinkedIn, Maria Halas. I'm the first Maria Halas without numbers on LinkedIn. And probably when you put Maria Halas on Google, I believe the first 200 pages. I don't know, for better or for worse. And go to strideequity.com.au, which is our website, and definitely you can find my details there as well.
Excellent. And we will pop those in the show notes as well. Before we go, don't forget, if you did enjoy this episode, please subscribe to the podcast through your favorite app, give us a rating and leave a quick review so that we can reach more people like you who want to unlock their influence. And as always, if you've got a question for me, you can find me on LinkedIn as well, or send me an email, samantha@theprhub.com.au. Maria, thank you so much, and thanks for listening. See you next time.
The Influence Unlocked podcast was presented by Samantha Dyback, CEO and founder of The PR Hub, and executive producer Andrew Menzel from Piccolo Podcasts. Want to connect with Samantha? The links to her LinkedIn and Instagram accounts are in the show notes.